Hello, and welcome to At Movies with Mike and Marie, a show where two film professors talk about movies. I'm Marie Westaver.
And I'm Mike Giuliano.
And today we're going to talk about Avatar, Fire and Ash, and Marty Supreme. So we're going to start with Avatar, Mike, a juggernaut of a franchise, if ever there was one. Lots of buzz for people waiting for this to come out. It's such a big, impressive, CGI-driven movie. Where do you even want to start?
We need to start with the running time.
Yes.
3 hours and 15 minutes. Now, I know the fan base will say, so what? There's a problem here. But for the rest of us who have a more casual interest, it's just so excessive. It's so drawn out. It's just inexcusable in a lot of ways. I mean, after all, this is the third film in the franchise. And I know there are always story strands, elements to pursue, but boy, this is stretched thin. Where it becomes a major problem, I would say, is that the film works really well in some ways and not at all in others. Mm-hmm. And scene by scene, you notice that. And it's kind of jarring, actually, for a few hours to sit through that. So on the plus side, and there is definitely a plus side here, when it comes to using 3D, James Cameron does it as well as anyone ever has. It truly is immersive. A little bit of backstory here, just in terms of the history of 3D. If you go back to the early 50s, when that gimmicky phase lasted just a few years and fizzled, not just because the glasses were uncomfortable and so on, but they did the basic and kind of, I almost say, vulgar thing back then. It's like, okay, well, we got 3D, so have somebody throw a spear at the audience, you know? And so things were always pushing out at you. It was propulsive, but pushing outward at you. And that could be very effective, but again, it's kind of gimmicky. What Cameron discovered, and he's not the first to, but really explored so well was, well, rather than having pushing out like that, have it push in, make it immersive. So where it works extremely well in all of the Avatar films is, you know, in action sequences, you really are along for the ride. It really pulls you into whatever the chase happens to be. And whether I care about the characters or not almost doesn't matter. It's just I'm being pulled into the action. And then what happens furthermore, and really to his credit, the treatment of water. I've got to say, you know, the last film, this one, oh, it's gorgeous. I mean, just, you know, on the water and even better under the water, mm-hmm. Just how beautifully modulated that is. And you know, it's a sort of a dream state almost when you enter into that. And yeah, you can go on for a few hours with that, I suppose. So that's all on the plus side, and it's a definite plus. On the minus side, and it's a considerable minus, is almost everything else. Dramatically, it's kind of confused or just, you know, not quite certain at times what it wants to do because it's bouncing from one character to another. And like, where am I supposed to focus in that sense? But the worst of it is the dialogue. I think this is dialogue that only a 12-year-old would find profound. And I realize I'm probably insulting very gifted 12-year-olds, so forgive me for that. But it has that sort of pseudo-profundity to it. But some of the lines they have to speak, I mean, if I would actually like to look at the script, just to look at the to see them in print, as they say, or on the screen, like somebody has to say this. And so not just that the scenes themselves are, you know, half-baked, but when you have dialogue as wooden as that, boy, it's excruciating. And so what happens is the film alternates really exciting action sequences with the dramatic underpinning scenes right after them, where it comes to almost a dead halt. And it squares off, and it's really kind of old-fashioned in a hokey way there. You know, I'm on one side of the frame, you're on the other, and we trade lines, and we have grave expressions on our face. And boy, that if ever there was a moment when you might want to go out for more popcorn or a bathroom break or something, that would be it. Ultimately, I found it, you know, a very disappointing film and a near endless disappointing film. One final note before turning it over to you after 3 hours and 15 minutes of my monologue is just that even though I have mixed and negative feelings about the film, you know, I'm happy that it's done so well commercially, just in the sense that the box office in 2025 was really low for some months, like October, like depressingly, disturbingly low, and only a few tentpole pictures were sort of holding it up that way. And the end of the year ended with a bang between Zootopia 2 and this and a few other things, that the box office for the year overall was up about, I know it's just a measly 1%, but up 1% from the previous year. So all things considered, the year wasn't a total washout. And so really, films like this did pull people into the theaters, and goodness knows we need that. So ultimately, I'm glad that it's done well commercially. But you know what? You would have to like tie me to the chair and put the 3D glasses on me to make me watch it again. I just don't think I could sit through it again. So I've gone on for quite a few hours. Back to you.
I agree with you that runtime is insane. And especially because I think some of the scenes just go on too long. So for those who think, I can't remember who said it, that you should never make your audience sit for longer than they can wait to go to the bathroom. If you need to get up and go to the bathroom during this movie, wait for one of the fight scenes. They go on for at least 10 minutes. When you come back, it will still be going on. I think it's irresponsible to make people sit that long, especially it kind of cheats the credits at the end because nobody can wait to through the credits. They're all racing for the doors to get to the bathroom. It's insane to me that you would make a movie that long. Unless one of your goals was to make sure nobody brought really, really little kids because they're never going to be able to sustain any sort of level of attention span. So maybe it's meant to weed out the people who aren't, it wasn't meant for. Having said that, the 3D is incredible. This is why people go see movies in IMAX and in 3D, because you cannot really recreate that in your home. And I was nodding when you said, you know, what they did with water was really great. I couldn't agree more. There was a scene where they actually positioned the camera like half underwater. And while you're watching it, you feel like you're underwater. It has a wonderful immersive feel to the way they put it together. You know, the flying ships they create are absolutely gorgeous. It almost takes your breath away. It's such a beautiful movie to look at. It's a feast for the eyes. If you go to watch it with that in mind, who cares about the dialogue and the story? That's just, you know, a conceit to get you to the next, you know, amazing feat, amazing accomplishment in terms of making you believe in this completely fictitious world, which in that respect, you have to hand it to James Cameron for being able to do that for three movies in a row.
Well, it's true when you mentioned, you know, getting immersed in the action just to go along for the ride, as we say. And that's probably why, as I was watching it, I was sort of spacing out in the sense of tracking the characters, but not really caring, not quite knowing, not, you know, just like not fully engaged with it. And you know, and that's where it was boring at times. Like, well, why are these two people talking to each other for 10 minutes, you know? So, but you raised a really interesting, I'll call it a child rearing question, namely that, and when I mentioned the overall box office for the year and all, in terms of the tentpole pictures, things doing well, what Hollywood discovered or just reinforced within the past year is that the really high grossing movies were rated PG-13, but many of them rated PG even. And what they found, and there have been some demographic studies here, is what's driving movie theater attendance right now is a generation aged about 13 to 25. And it's that demographic that is not only going, but going that first weekend, kind of driving the box office and dragging their parents along, I guess, in some cases. So in a business sense, it's been smart to have these PG and PG-13 movies that are getting kids that age. And this is partly speculative, but these demographic studies have said, you know, even though these kids are totally tied into their phones and social media and this and that, well, what's one of the things being driven on social media? Namely, hey, here's a new Avatar movie or new Zootopia, whatever, got to go. And, you know, it's that impulse. And kids still have that impulse just to get out of the house and away from their parents, even if the parents are the ones dragging them to the movie theater. You know, there's a lot to mull over there as to why it's these films in particular. Not that this hasn't been a phenomenon for quite a while, but in the last year, it became really pronounced that way, that like a lot of R-rated films just weren't doing that well at the box office, almost regardless of genre, just weren't doing much. But PG, PG-13, big spectacles, tent poles, and so on really work. But there's an underlying concern or question in what you were saying and what I'm reiterating, namely that you talk, you know, about kids having notoriously short attention spans, and particularly for really small kids, you know, to have them sit for a few hours like that. It seems to me a large part of the target demographic of the real fan base would be, you know, at the younger end of the spectrum. But what do you think about that? I'm thinking out loud here because I'm just sort of wondering, you know, thinking back to, well, gee, when you're 5 years old or 8 years old, whatever, if the movie goes over 3 hours, is there some sort of almost genetic issue there that, you know, at that age, I can't do it. What do you think here? Let me tap into your knowledge of child rearing skills.
I don't know how well that's going to translate, but I did notice in this movie that instead of the focus being on Jake Sully and Neytiri, it's much more focused on the younger characters, the kids. And I think that's probably intentional to give you like new people to follow in subsequent movies, because apparently there's going to be a 4 and a 5. So I think that was a deliberate choice. As far as that goes, I'm kind of glad that they were able to use Sigourney Weaver in a interesting way so that she could be introduced to younger audiences as if she's younger, as if she's the age of the character she's depicting, because I love Sigourney Weaver. What do you think, Mike? Was this a way to try to bring in a slightly younger group to follow through with 4 and 5?
Well, you know, I think we're onto something here in the sense that, you know, that immersive 3D pulls all of us in. But if you're a kid, that could be kind of mesmerizing, keep you with it. And then moreover, by way of protagonist, the really good point you make is that the emphasis does shift a bit here. It's a bit more off of the adult characters and more onto a few of the children. And as the children worry about the adults, right? And so by way of identification, I think that's a good point and a very shrewd one from a marketing perspective, because when further sequels come along, and we're sure they will, yeah, why not then have the film track those younger characters as they go along? But among the older characters, curious, and I think, frankly, kind of frustrating is, yes, I share your affection for Sigourney Weaver. I mean, I've interviewed her once. I love her as an actress and so on. But what's kind of odd here is that she really appears very briefly in the film. I mean, it's almost along the lines of a cameo in some ways. And yet in the credits, I mean, she's right up there near the top there in terms of stars of the film. So they're making the most of her presence there. But I don't think she really has that great a role within the film itself. It's just simply that we have her, which is almost like the prize. Here she is. And it sort of came across that way to me. But then when they get to the end credits, like, bam, there's the name. And, you know, she's the big star of it. And that maybe that, as you say, that might be a way of introducing the child audience member to someone who could be their grandmother, frankly. It could be that. But also for older, for more mature viewers, there is that that pleasure. And it really is one of, you know, an actress we love. And here she is. And so, you know, that's reason enough right there.
So one thing I thought was a flaw is that, and I understand why they do it, they shot this movie when they shot the second one. And some of the actors were able to sort of age in place and give it that continuity. And I like that sort of forward thinking and planning. But it makes the second and the third movie seem very similar. First one stands on its own. 2 and 3, I think, are just very, very similar. And the other thing I noticed was, you know, Cameron has described this film as the hinge where the Avatar saga stops being mythic and becomes political. And I'm not sure I'm on board with that. I like the mythic part better.
Dabbling in politics can be dangerous, right? It can be hazardous to your health. I think you're right. They're better off if they do not try to draw, you know, political parallels, because goodness knows, you know, well, when we look at this story and the Na'vi people and this and that, do I want to connect those dots? Do I want to make connections between their world and mine? Not particularly. One reason why I watch Avatar is to get away from my political world. I'll put it that way. Better just to deal in the mythic, because then when you're dealing in the mythic, you at your own imaginative level can make whatever political connections you might care to, but they're not forced on you, because in a mythic story, it's in many ways self-contained. I mean, go back to the Greek myths. I mean, you know, we follow those stories and they work on their own terms. And yes, we make connections or applications from what they dealt with and what we deal with, but it's not forced on you by the original myth. See, that's the point I'm making. It's there and you can make of it what you will. I think it's a very risky strategy. And in this film, there are places where you can see it sort of pushing into political territory. But Hollywood has a history of making what I call apolitical, non-political, political films. It's like they're always very cautious that way because they want to sell tickets. I mean, they're not going to stump for a candidate, right? So when they make a kind of political statement, sometimes it's a sort of namby-pamby, wishy-washy, you know, what to make of it. You're better off probably not making it at all, right? Rather than that kind of quasi-political statement. But I'm glad you said that, because it sort of bothered me too. It seemed like the film, again, that pseudo-profundity in it, that was part of it, wasn't it? That it was just sort of like pushing things like that. And I thought, give me a break. Just give me some more underwater action.
Nobody was there for a political movie, I don't think. So I will mention three things that I did think were awesome. One is Charlie Chaplin's granddaughter, Una Chaplin, playing one of the villains. That was kind of awesome. You do get to have that fun fun thing of Avatar where you get to fly dragons around. What's not to like? And finally, what I thought was just absolutely gorgeous, and it's true of all the Avatar movies, is the way they do the makeup where they've got these sparkly freckles. And it just gives it such a beautiful look and feel. I just found that just magical.
Well, one of the nice things about the makeup, and you're absolutely right, is that even though these creatures are, you know, not quite human, or, you know, however we describe them, we make those anthropomorphic connections. And there are, you know, serious plot concerns here in terms of like who's human and who's not quite human and this and that. But one of the reasons why that is intriguing in the film is the makeup, actually, because when you see these creatures and that kind of spangly, sparkly facial makeup, it's like, well, in some ways they don't quite look like my next door neighbor, but, you know, but they have human and even humane qualities, right? They're probably even better than people in a lot of ways. And they have better makeup for sure. So, you know, we just do it at Halloween. They do it year round.
Maybe when you start off with blue, maybe you have more options. So we need to move on to Marty Supreme, which I will say that the Avatar movie is the movie people were talking about. Oh, it's opening. Oh, I can't wait to go see it. This movie is a movie I keep hearing people talk about, but it didn't have the buzz of Avatar. The buzz is all around the main actor, Timothée Chalamet, who I think no matter what he does is noteworthy. He is just like the man of the hour. He is having a moment, as they say. So much to say about this, but, you know, we needed to explain that this is a movie about table tennis, except it's not. So, Mike, take it away.
Well, Timothée Chalamet, not only is having a moment, he's having a career. We you know, early on, he made a splashy entrance into cinema, and you think, gee, is it going to be a moment? But it's a moment that's turning into a career. He recently turned 30 years old. When you look at the range of roles he's played, it's so impressive. And it's a great pleasure to, as a moviegoer, to see an actor like that not only make a splashy debut, but then follow up on it, and in a way that's really showing his versatility as an actor. And a rather, you know, not a conventional leading man by any means. I got to say, like in Dune, even though as a gifted actor, I could appreciate him there, I thought, gee, you know, how is it that this scrawny kid is beating up villains who have much more muscular power than he does, but he's somehow winning the fight. But even there, as an actor, he's convincing. He manages to make that work. So anyway, it's just a great pleasure to see him. And there actually was some buzz for this film. I know people I was talking with through the fall mentioned it as a film they were looking forward to. And it did actually, for a film of its nature and with its subject matter, table tennis, not automatic big box office, I got to say, the film really, you know, opened well commercially, and it's getting, you know, nominations and different award ceremonies. And so it is getting recognized that way for sure. And the Oscars, I know for sure, will look kindly on it that way. The great strength of the film is that central performance. And although the film is extremely entertaining, I mean, it's really an enjoyable film to watch. Again, maybe I'm fixated on running time, but this film has a running time of 149 minutes. And where it started to not quite lose me, but where my patience was wearing a little thin is, Chalamet plays this table tennis whiz. And he's really like so talented at that particular sport. And yet his personality has its share of flaws, he's not the nicest person, to put it bluntly. And he's so blustery with his self-confidence. I love when he says, I could sell shoes to an amputee. Well, it's so politically incorrect, some of the stuff he says and does, that you got to kind of laugh at it and just go along. But here's the issue I had. There are many very entertaining scenes that reinforce his personality. And Chalamet's terrific in the performance. But how much reinforcement do we need there? You know, scene after scene, competition after competition. And so the film, I think, you know, skims along. The director, Josh Safdie, does a really great job with, you know, taking you through those scenes, but scene after scene making essentially the same point. So I think that reinforcement is ultimately superficial, in the sense that there's really not much depth here. And I'm not sure I want a lot of armchair psychoanalysis or what makes this guy tick, et cetera, but I don't think the film goes very deep in that respect. I think it just enjoys skimming along the surface. What do you think?
Yes, I think they set up all of these pins for Chalamet to knock down. And to his credit, he does a wonderful job. And like you said, some of the time you're rooting for the underdog, and some of the time you're waiting for him to get his comeuppance. But it is way too long. It's certainly way too long just to be a character study or a movie about table tennis. It is just too long. And it lingers too long over certain scenes. I think they could have cut out the whole Gwyneth Paltrow thing, I think altogether, even though I thought she was actually pretty good in it, there's a whole thing about a stolen dog that devolves into this kind of Coen brothers sort of insanity that I thought kind of broke up the rhythm too. There were a lot of things like that where it's like, could we just get back to the story? I felt like it was wasting a lot of time to give Timothée Chalamet a chance to, you know, strut around a little bit more. And I felt like there was plenty of that.
Well, you know what? I mean, he's among the producers and, you know, and among the creative forces behind it. And that's a mixed blessing here because it really gives him a very long leash, doesn't it? And while I'm mixing metaphors and all, it is really a Shaggy Dog story in a lot of ways. And it goes off in some odd directions. And it has an interesting cast of supporting players. Some of them, you know, people that are recognizable. It could be the director Abel Ferrara in an acting role here, or Fran Drescher, people that, you know, that you've seen. And it's kind of like a quirky ensemble cast that way. And I enjoy some of the picaresque aspects of, you know, this and that. But you're right. Ultimately, that's kind of frustrating. Well, where's this story subplot headed? What are we doing here? And the one that ultimately bothered me after a while had to do with Gwyneth Paltrow. Now, on the one hand, it was wonderful to have her back on screen, and it's really a very good role for her. She really is so good in this. But do we need that? Her character, she plays a movie star who's a bit past her prime, and she's doing some stage work now. And it's the sort of person, like if she walked into a hotel lobby, somebody might say, isn't that so-and-so, or didn't she used to be so-and-so kind of thing? And she's not that old as a movie star character, but, you know, she hasn't been all that active, nor has Gwyneth Paltrow, you know, at least in big screen roles in recent years. So it really works very well that way and kind of melds the character with the actress playing her, actually, in terms of issues she might be facing. Here's the problem with it. Without spoiling anything in the storyline, Timothée Chalamet's character here, Marty Supreme, he's so scuzzy in a lot of ways. He's so untrustworthy and just, you know, a schemer and an operator and this and that. And they meet, and when he meets the movie star character, without spoiling anything in the storyline, as they develop a kind of relationship, at gut level, I never found it convincing. Mm-hmm. I just thought, no, that she wouldn't. Why would she bother with this guy for 5 minutes? And the fact that it goes on was kind of irritating after a while. I thought, well, she should ditch him, dump him, get rid of him. Like, you know, like if you had a pesky fan who wouldn't leave you alone, it's like, security, you know, get this guy out of here. But the fact that she gives him more than the time of day, I honestly just didn't buy it. How about you?
I didn't buy it either. And I think one of the reasons is there's a scene where Timothée Chalamet opens the door and he's shirtless. And he is this scrawny, insubstantial dork of a guy. I think I just don't see even a washed up movie star bothering with him. He has a certain amount of charm, but it turns irritating so quickly every single time. And the underlying question, I think, while you're watching it is, you know, is Marty talented or is he just unstoppable because he believes he is? It's inspired by a real person. And I can't help but wonder, you know, what was the intellectual property they used? Did they just go with that sort of idea about this real man and then make a whole movie about it? Or was he like on record as being this hustler who screwed over literally everybody he ever met?
Well, the table tennis action on its own terms is really well staged. It's really convincing, you know, and the fact that, you know, you have, you know, movie star actors, like Timothée Chalamet, who again, he whatever role he takes on, he makes it convincing. Like I said, even in Dune, he's going to defeat these big muscular guys. The scrawny guy's going to win, right? But in the table tennis scenes, he's really good. But I think you hit on something here, at least as the movie character presented. It's a combination of genuine talent and chutzpah. This guy is supremely self-confident. He's got this blustery self-confidence, and that counts for a lot and gets him pretty far in life in a lot of ways. I still don't think it would get him into Gwyneth Paltrow's arms, but that's just me. She can pick whoever she wants to pick, you know, as a movie star actress. I don't know. The movie doesn't always work for me, and yet the direction of it is really secure. It's a well-made film. Technically, it's extremely entertaining. And even when I thought scenes were unnecessary or went on too long, or there were those diversionary sidebars or subplots. Yeah, I would strike some of those too. And yet, as you're watching them, they are engaging. They hold your interest. And I thought the film itself really had a lot going for it, just by way of it gave me a lot to think about as I watched it, you know? And I mean, and I don't go into it like being a particular fan of the sport. And I, you know, I'm watching it for that central performance. And then for better, for worse, it's that central performance that really anchors the film. I mean, the film wouldn't be much of anything without Timothée Chalamet.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And I honestly cannot imagine anybody having enough charisma to pull this off. Like, I can't even imagine Brad Pitt pulling this off, because he would be smooth all the time. I mean, one of the beauty parts of the role is that this kid is just so incredibly flawed. Like, he's seducing people, but he's actually just this scrawny dork of a guy.
Yeah, but you know what? But Brad Pitt would get Gwyneth Paltrow.
Oh, he totally would. Yes. That would be a great scene.
That would be a great scene. Come on.
It would, especially given the, you know, the history they have. I can't help but wonder, though, because there's a very prominently featured girlfriend in the movie, and this guy must have had family. How do they feel about this depiction of him? Is it accurate? Or is it, you know, this is Hollywood?
Yeah, I don't know the backstory and the true story well enough to really answer that. So watching it just as a film, what I liked about that was the sense of the confidence man. I mean, it's interesting to watch that. This guy who can talk himself into, sometimes even when people don't quite believe him, they're so struck by the brazenness of him, right? Mm-hmm. It's that kind of a character. Like, even if you know he's full of it and then he's a con man, it's like, what? Got to like laugh at him or admire him or something. And it gets him pretty far. In a lot of ways, it can be his undoing at times, but it really gets him pretty far in life. And also the fact that, you know, even though we've talked about his many character flaws, goodness knows he lives in a world of flawed characters. You know, it's not like he's, you know, somehow like the odd man out. There are a lot of odd men out, not women out in this film. And that's one thing that I thought that the director, Josh Safdie, handled really well. Just show you the eccentricities of people. And some of them, you're right, don't really add up to much plot wise, but it's like quirky and interesting that way. It's like going to a bar and you see all these weird characters and you go with this one for a few minutes and that one for a few minutes. And yeah, you know, ultimately it goes on too long and it's not satisfying there. But for a while, you're along for the ride and like, what makes him tick? You know, I mean, it's just that curiosity about other people.
Yeah, and the best scenes are where he is. You know they've got him dead to rights, but somehow you know he's just going to squirm out of it with fast talk. Those are really fun scenes to watch. But I will come back to the fact that for the family of the real person, I mean, the family of the guy in the movie, they're terrible people. His mom, his uncle, they're terrible people.
So, well, see, that's why, you know, the apple didn't fall very far from that tree, because that's the point I was making just a moment ago. The fact that, you know, it's easy to fault him and criticize him in different ways, but look what he comes from, you know, in terms of his upbringing. You can't blame him for wanting to get out of that, away from that. And if somehow, whether through training or gene pool, I mean, enough of that's still with him, that, you know, this is what he's coming from. And he's a scrappy guy who does whatever he has to do to get ahead. I mean, he will steal money from his own family business, he'll do this and that. But, you know, but the people he's stealing from really aren't much better in an ethical sense, are they? So, you know, I don't feel too sorry for them in a way. And he's doing what he's got to do. That's how he sees it. He can brazenly go to tournaments and this and that and just talk his way in. And I thought, well, you can hate him, but you almost have to admire him.
Mm-hmm. Just for the sheer cussedness, yes, you have to admire him. But, you know, he is terrible to his friends. One of the most satisfying scenes is all the orange ping pong balls going out the window. That was a high moment, I think. But that does bring us to the end of our show. But don't forget to check out our other shows at atmhcc.podbean.com. And we'll see you next time at the movies.
See you then.
Thanks for tuning in. If you enjoyed what you just heard, we have a whole universe of podcasts waiting for you. Simply search Dragon Podcasts wherever you get your podcasts. You can also explore our full lineup and discover new shows at podbean.com/dragonpodcasts. That's podbean.com/dragonpodcasts.